We welcome in our friend, author Colin Fleming, on this Tuesday afternoon. Hello, Colin.
Hey, what's up, Kimball?
I'm doing fine, thanks. Enjoying the beautiful day. People getting out of your way on the steps. What's happening today?
Funnily, you should mention that. I was just talking to someone. I cut the steps short of 1,000 today because there were a lot of people eating up the space, Kimball. Had like a 5-person convoy, and they weren't maybe in the best fitness, so that added a bit of space taking up into everything. And then they were a couple feet apart, and there was a tour group at the top, and it just wasn't going great for my BP, so I curtailed my stair-based activities. I'm ashamed, but I was still out there at least for a little bit.
Well, yeah, people in your way, there's only so much you can do.
I got out there late. I don't like to, I don't eat until night. So I don't like to really, I like to do a lot in the morning. I don't want to go hitting the stairs at 2 in the afternoon, which is how it was. And I still had a bunch of my push-ups to do with my whole new form thing, and it takes a while. And it's like 11 days in a row that I've been out there. So I could have just skipped it. So it's sort of one of those little victories when even though you just did 1,000 stairs.
Now, yeah, I noticed that you've adjusted your form. You've tucked in the elbows a little bit and pulled the arms in a little tighter to make those push-ups even more productive.
I don't even know that. I hope I'm doing it right at this point. I'm wondering now if I've overcompensated too much in the salubrious direction, if you will. But I was doing them all wrong before. I wasn't getting no benefit from them, I'm pretty sure. But my hands were in the wrong position, my forearms weren't doing what they're supposed to do, and then I adjusted, and I went from being able to just do a set of 50 to really 15. It's pretty difficult. And so now I'm just concentrating on doing 100 each day, which is what I was doing most of the days before. I went up as high as 1,000, but again, I was doing them the wrong way. And you watch these, do you ever see these YouTube videos of these guys doing this stuff?
And oh, yeah.
It's so easy for them. And I don't need to be that guy, but I just want to be the guy who's still in that, like, 98th percentile among the lay people. That's sort of my goal. So I think I'm there.
No question about that. Well, today we talk about one of our favorite topics to discuss with you here on the program, Orson Welles, and a film that probably not as many people have seen, no question. People haven't seen it as much as they've seen Citizen Kane, but Chimes at Midnight in many ways. And by the way, this will be the subject of a new book that Colin's working on called Chimes at Midnight and the Heart of Orson Welles. Is it safe to say that this was in many ways his life's work?
He viewed it that way. I view it that way. Now, it's tricky to say something is Orson Welles' life work when that phrase encompasses so many works that go into that collage makeup of the man and the artistry, but he viewed this as something that he had to make. And I viewed this when I was a teenager as something that I had to see. I had read about this, and as you said a moment ago, not as many people, of course, have seen this as Citizen Kane, but for a long time, very few people had seen this because it was difficult to see. It wasn't really out there. So teenage Colin hunted down bootleg copy. That's how serious I was about this. And it's available now lavishly, or as lavishly as this particular film can exist, in a Blu-ray edition. The sound and the images are off and off kilter. We can get to that. That's also part of its effect, part of its charm, part of its singularity, I would say. But I knew that this was a story about a friendship that had a father-son component. And I also knew that it was a film ultimately about betrayal. And it's extreme betrayal, but it's not maybe as negative as that term connotes, because there's still affection within the betrayal. So I knew, really, that sounded unlike anything I had ever heard of. And as I've gone on in life, it's remained unique. There isn't really anything that deals in betrayal quite like this film does. I mean, we have so many different examples of betrayal. You think about Dante's Inferno. What is we go down through the layers of levels of hell, and each sin gets worse and worse and worse and worse. And what is the worst thing for Dante at the lowest level of the lowest level? It's betrayal. So this was also a film that Wells was looking to make about a person in Falstaff that he believed was the only truly good character, person, potentially, in all of the English-speaking world. And I just was enamored by that conceit right from when I read him saying remarks to that nature.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. A remarkable process. It began with a book that he wrote as a young man, a stage play, and essentially to create the screenplay for this film, he combined elements of several different Shakespearean works.
Wells was a master editor, and I feel like that's something that that doesn't get enough attention in terms of his artistry, in terms of his gifts. He could take something and slash away a good 35% of it and have it be tight and not have it feel lacking. And what he does with Chimes of Midnight is he essentially amalgamates five different Shakespeare plays. Now, it's a journey to this film. He's, like you said, writing a book on Shakespeare in his teens with his mentor, Roger Hill. He is doing a stage version, essentially, of Chimes of Midnight under a different title in the late 1930s. In 1960, so a few years before filming starts on this particular film, he's doing another theatrical version. It's the last work in the theater that he's ever going to do, and it's kind of a dry run for what the film is going to be. So he's traveling, in a sense, towards this project. He had this history with his own father. Like I said, there's a father-son dynamic. It's not an actual father-son that comprises this particular friendship, although there is a real father, too, in King Henry IV. But Wells's father, his mother died when he was young, and his father was an alcoholic, and his behavior was, as is often the case with people who have alcohol issues, was quite bad and uncontrollable. And young Orson thought maybe he could help rein in his father's drinking by saying that he wouldn't see him when he was in that condition. And shortly thereafter, Wells's father died. And for the rest of his life, Wells always blamed himself as actually having murdered his father.
It's a remarkable film. I had seen it maybe 4 or 5 years ago and then watched it again last night. And it's so powerful. And Wells' performance is just, it's one for the ages. And when you consider the fact I was looking at it, he was only, 48, 49 years old when he shot most of that film?
Right. Wells and age is just one of those strange concepts that you have to sort of work to get your head around. It's almost like the Beatles in time, or me in time, frankly. But Wells, when we see a photo of him at 3 years old, in many ways, he looks like the Wells of 1985, the year that he died. Like, you can see it in the eyes. When he was the boy wonder, he was so mature beyond his actual years. And so when he's playing this role, it's hard to believe that he is in the middle of life. If he was a push-up master, which watching the film and seeing the battle sequence, you can kind of deduce that he probably wasn't a push-up master. He might have stayed around. One of the things about Orson Welles, it's not a terribly old age that he made it to, but I'm always surprised that he got into his 70s in a way, because he had, think of that, he had the rest of this decade, the 70s and half of the 80s to go after he made this film. But it was something that just meant so much to him. And he believed in this Edenic kind of idea of merry old England. And I do too. People are just so rubbish now. They're barbarians to each other. They're often low class. They don't have the vaguest understanding of common courtesy. And that's not how merry old England was, and certainly not how merry old England was in Orson Welles' considerable imagination.
And Falstaff is such a great character, but almost always played as a comic character. But you point out in your writing here that Welles viewed him also ultimately as a tragic character.
He came to discover him that way. When Welles was doing those theatrical versions that I mentioned, Falstaff ended up being played for laughs. That's just what came out. And people took him as this kind of, he's a Zaftig character. He's large appetites for food, drink, sex. He's always hanging out at the Boar's Head Tavern. He's like a more erudite version a lustier, more erudite version of Norm. Cheers. You have the hostelry in common, and pranks and childishness and imitations, and these two guys, Falstaff and Prince Hal, they're kind of Norman Cliff in a way, but much smarter than we get with Norm and Cliff. So, yeah, there's a lot of body fun to be had here. Now, it sounds maybe strange for Wells to make this remark about Falstaff's essential goodness, because he's doing a lot of a wenching, Kimball. And you know how it is. When you're out in the town, it's like, let's go out a wenching tonight. You're probably thinking about the confessional the next day. Oh, no, I have some stuff that I'm going to have to fess up to. But he's just so pure and guileless of heart. He's a true friend. And Hal, who, for people who don't know the story, it's sort of a teen drama without a teen, where dad wants the king, wants his son to grow up and stop hanging around with these boozing losers, which is what Prince Hal is doing. He's not taking his potential position. He's next in line for the throne after King Henry IV does some murdering. And he's just hanging out with this good-for-nothing sort of corrupting influence. And Prince Hal tells Falstaff at one point, before it happens, that, hey, I'm going to put my back to you someday, and you're really not going to like how that goes. And they sort of continue carrying on. But even from the first time I saw this film, it just struck me that he knew something all along. And then things happen, and they happen rather rapidly. King Henry IV's health begins to fail. There's a war to be had. You have the single greatest, in my view, battle sequence. I don't want to hear Saving Private Ryan. The single greatest battle sequence in all of cinema, with the Battle of Shrewsbury, and how well shot that over so much time just to get 6 minutes of film. If you read like an account by a private, like a diary from the Civil War, battles aren't like what they're depicted in movies. The animals, their heads are just exploding. Like, people never really sort of talk about that. You don't really see that. You get a sense here for just the disintegration of all living forms in the mud, the return to the ooze.
And the sound is so powerful in that battle scene.
Oh, that's where, you know what it reminds me of? It's two things, really. Some of the best mid-century horror radio programs, they got by on the way they could induce your squeamishness with their sounds. Like, there's a monster chomping on brains, and you got a sense for what it was. When Wells made Dracula, okay, in 1938, he went through a lot of labors to get the proper sound of a stake being driven through an undead person's heart. He ultimately settled on a watermelon. But when people in the country heard that stake going through the watermelon, there was a big collective gasp. Wells, he was a sound merchant, and radio was where he was most comfortable. It was what he believed himself to be best at. He brings his radio chops to bear on this intensely visual, at the same time, battle sequence. And so you could just excise that from the film, play it for people, and it's its own short film. This is what war looks like. And he's only working with like less than 200 people, but he makes it seem like thousands.
There are also so many wonderful scenes I love, and there are a couple of scenes where it's Falstaff and Justice Shallow and Justice Silence, and just the three of them are so very good together.
They're very good, they're very funny, and yet, for such an inebrious film, they're very sobering. The notion of behind the title, Chimes at Midnight, that's like when we were talking recently about Make Way for Tomorrow. Do you see how they're similar titles? Chimes at Midnight means like it's like November 30th. We're getting late in the year of our existence. Things are changing. And it's like I wrote in a story recently, that life is designed to pass you by. That's sort of like the operating premise of life. And that's really just one of those things that this film is about. But it's also, it's like a locker room film in a way. Like they go out and they rob some people. And some of his comrades, they pull a joke on Falstaff and they rob him, and he doesn't realize who it is, and it comes back to the Boar's Head Tavern, and he's like, well, you should have seen me out there. I was just kicking some ass. It was really remarkable how I was fighting back. And they're all like trying not to laugh at him. And I don't know if you've ever been 15 or 16, or if it's like you're a meathead or something like that, you're like, yeah, I get that. Like you've sort of been there, no matter whether you're male, female, whatever you might be. And there's a lot of that kind of friendship. It's a film about friendship. Friendship is just so potent. Friendship undergirds not just friendship itself. I think it's the substrate of every single consequential relationship. At different degrees, people have different amounts of power. There's different amounts of things that people are counted on doing. But whether it's the parent-child, whether it's the artist-audience, there's always friendship. I'm doing this for you so that you might have a better time of it. I think that's really the nature of friendship. And that's why when we come to the, to me, what is one of the two most heartbreaking sequences in all of cinema, the other one being when Scrooge in the 1951 film turns up at Nephew Fred's house after he sort of found himself again. When the king has died and Prince Hal, he's coming back, he gets to be the king now, and Falstaff thinks this is wonderful. He's going to be a big man on campus, meaning in the kingdom. And he shows up at the coronation hoping for something that he just does not end up getting.
And it's such an incredibly powerful scene. And so much of it is just there on Wells' face, that combination of defeat, humiliation, and yet a fair amount of pride that you see as well.
It's Orson Welles' greatest turn as an actor. And everyone knows the baronial voice and the narrator, voice of God type of deal. And Harry Lime and the Third Man and all of the different ages he plays in Citizen Kane. But for just a distilled moment, so he's in the castle and he's speaking to Prince Hal's back at one point. I mean, visually, there's nothing accidental in this film. Everything is happening for a reason. Everything is set up a certain way. It just has the design of pure physics. And he thinks that he's going to get this opportunity to be sort of one of the main guys of the kingdom. And exactly what Prince Hal said was going to happen ends up happening. And despite the effusions of Wells' Falstaff, Prince Hal says to him, oh, I mean, it's so upsetting. He says, I know thee not, old man. I mean, you think about that. It's not just you're not getting this. I don't even know you. And that just doesn't mean like you're dead to me, lose the number. That means something else. It speaks to souls and hearts. And there's this sort of double beat. It's not just the one. It's a double beat where Wells is looking at him. And we see him pass through the heartbreak that's going to momentarily kill him when he gets back to the Boar's Head Tavern. And also this admiration, this actual love sans condition. That's what he has for his friend, who is actually in his mind and in his heart doing the right thing as king by removing this relationship from his life.
Yeah, it's an incredible scene. We're talking about Chimes at Midnight, the 1966 Orson Welles film. Colin Fleming with us. Not a perfect film, and I'm not sure that Welles cared about that. One of the things that apparently happened along the way is they had some sound issues and had to do some looping and dub in some of the dialogue. And it's fun at times to recognize Welles' voicing of other characters.
It also increases, I think, the intensity of one's concentration. I don't think it works against the film as a film, but it will put off certain people. I haven't put it up yet, but I was writing on the blog where there's this edition of M.R. James's stories, this most complete edition, and the paragraphs were shortened, like for the quote-unquote modern reader. And I thought, well, that's kind of extraneous. If someone's going to be reading M.R. James, they even know who he is. That's the type of thing that they're not going to be bothered by, except when they find out that that's what happened, and then they're going to be all up in arms. I don't think that the sort of fallbacks, the shortcomings of this particular film really work against it. Like a well-known example is Margaret Rutherford, who was starring at the same time in Agatha Christie dramas in England. She's Mistress Quickly, who is she's kind of the hostess of the Boar's Head Tavern. And Wells really liked the speech that she made after Falstaff dies at the end. And there's like all of these sound imperfections on the tape. Mm. And he kept it because the performance was what he wanted it to be. And there are sequences where they have, he said, seven different actors in them. And none of the actors that you see on the screen are the people who were originally cast because they had other commitments as this project dragged on and on and on, as Wells's projects were wont to do. And so he was ad-libbing. He was shooting from behind. He was pasting it together, to use a phrase from F. Scott Fitzgerald, as he went along. So it somehow coheres. And the reason it coheres is because of its integrity of heart, I feel like. This is something that meant a lot to him, and while he didn't have necessarily the means to maybe get everything quote-unquote perfect, he got everything real, and I think that's the bigger takeaway.
While the film also indulges in his love of Old England, certainly elements of Kenosha, Wisconsin, where he went to school as a young man, how do we see that? Where does he take us to youthful Wisconsin during Chimes of Midnight?
I think he's working out a lot of what happened with his, it's not autobiography, but it's like when I was a teenager and I was in high school, I was like this big hockey star and everything, but I didn't really have a lot of friends. I wasn't well-liked, and part of that was because I'd be going from hockey practice to, like, back to school so I could discuss Shakespeare with a teacher. That's always what I was most interested in, no matter anything else, And I feel that, like, I would listen to something like The Who's Quadrophenia, and it wasn't autobiography. I wasn't like a mod fighting on a beach in Brighton. But that notion of alienation and loneliness was something that I was able to identify, even as I recognized it as somewhat separate from my own experience. And I think that's what Wells did with Chimes at Midnight when it came to his own father. I mean, you could go round and round. You could say, okay, well, exactly, is Falstaff meant to be Wells? Is Falstaff meant to be the father that he believed he murdered? Or was he someone who had acquired a wisdom before his time? And a lot of wisdom, frankly, is how well you ask questions, how well you probe, how far you're willing to go in your exploration and your openness. And I've learned that when you create things, what you want to do is you want to be both clear. You want to impart to people, but you also want to have some mystery. When people can get in there and raise their hand in the classroom, I'm sure you know that, lots of fruitful discussions from your time teaching where the next kid wants to say something after the first kid said something. And so I think that's what Wells' father-son dynamic from his own life allowed him to bring to bear on this film. I think he grew up fast, and he didn't really have a child in some ways, which also makes this kind of therapeutic for him in the sense that it's a film about play. These guys play. They have a good time. It was marketed, I mean, you can understand why, like, as a comedy, and it's, you know what it sort of reminds me of? It's like With Nail and I. With Nail and I is a very sort of Chimes at Midnight film. It's a movie about friendship and betrayal in a way, and that one person has success and the other doesn't. They sort of part company, these two good friends. So there's just a lot happening with that. There's a lot of different ways to be a father. There's a lot of different ways to be a son, and they don't necessarily involve like what someone's age is and what the sort of de facto relationship is.
We also get to see a young Orson Welles, in a sense, with his daughter Beatrice playing the page, looking remarkably like Orson Welles did at that age.
Yeah, it's really sweet to have her there. It makes it, it just gives it this vibe. Even, I mean, of course, if like you know that after the fact that that's who she is, but Wells didn't, he didn't do a lot of that. And he had a complicated relationship too with his own family and with people. I feel like it was hard for him to find a way to fit in. So with the book I'm doing, that's partially where the title comes from. It was late 1950s, and he was writing a letter to Bernard Herrmann, who, of course, scored, I mean, so many great films and worked with Wells and got his sort of start with the Mercury Theater. And Wells, at the end of the letter, he reminds Herrmann and reminds himself that your heart is God's little garden. Because I think it was very easy for Wells to not suffer fools willingly and to kind of lash out. And yet he was evolving into this part, because as he went along in life, he was growing his own fundamental goodness. Wells worked hard, I feel like, at being a good person. It doesn't just happen. You don't just come out and it's like, oh, I'm so benevolent. It's not really like that. That's just not how, again, it's just not a way that life is designed. And you have to have that recognition. You have to have that acute sensibility that you're going to have this purpose and this vision directed towards being someone who abets the causes of others. And that's really sort of he's pushed into the sacrifice. He doesn't have a say at the end of this film, Falstaff, that is. But he's also tacitly going along with that sacrifice. And maybe that's even what his death is, the removal of this reminder to this person that he wants to see succeed. And maybe if that other personage wasn't removed, success going forward will be harder to come by.
What had he learned, either about himself or about filmmaking, in the 25 years since Kane that we see in Chimes at Midnight?
He's grown up. There's a first album type of element to Citizen Kane, where he didn't want to go to Hollywood, and they just kept raising the price. I mean, really, considering what Wells became to Hollywood, like hated, blackballed, that just a short time before, people were throwing money at him. It just goes to show that people can get caught up in the wrong things so easily, right? I mean, look at the success of Skip Bayless. People just throw money at, like well, right, they'll throw money at a moron. I mean, the Village Idiot. Wells and F. Scott Fitzgerald is looking at this thinking, he wrote a short story in which Wells, a fictionalized version of Wells featured, where he's like, well, what's going on here? Why are they just, this guy's never even done this. And so he was just, it was a lark, and he wanted to see what he could get away with. And Greg Toland was a willing accomplice. The cinematographer is like, I'll show you how to get away with some stuff. I can teach you everything about the camera in a weekend, and we'll just do this crazy deep focus that I've been experimenting with. He was always up to something sort of tricky. Even on Chimes at Midnight, like by hook or by crook, the film was going to be made. He gets this guy to give him money to make the film. The guy's like, well, I don't really want to do Shakespeare. I don't think people are going to go for that. Well, it's like, don't worry about it. Right. You're into Treasure Island. We'll do Treasure Island.
Right, I'll do a two-for-one deal for you,
yeah,
right?
Two-for-one. So then, like, he builds these sets. Part of the reason the Boar's Head Tavern looks the way it does, like the only set, is because it could also double as a set for Treasure Island. I mean, he just was lying. He was blagging his way through the entire thing. He was very focused on making this. And I'd say that was the difference with Citizen Kane. He almost, like, fell backwards into it. And this, he went, like, full force into. He had to, like, sometimes we talk about this there. Sometimes when it's raining and it's just, like, miserable and I don't want to go on in life or whatever, and I still go out there, and I'm running up those stairs for whatever day in a row and everyone else is asleep, I think to myself, you really have to believe in something to be doing this like you're doing this. I think Orson Welles could have said the same thing to himself about Chimes at Midnight.
Collins' upcoming book will be called God's Little Garden, Chimes at Midnight and the Heart of Orson Welles. Also, check out Collins' terrific blog post today, which I thought was fascinating to go along with this, the idea that people don't really like Orson Welles' movies.
Yeah, I would say that they don't. I belong to all these sort of Facebook groups that are, maybe you do too, like these more groups and classic Hollywood groups, and just anecdotally from people I've known in my life, or even when I've gone to Orson Welles films with people, they tend to think they're austere or they're intimidated by Citizen Kane, or they're these kind of theoretical exercises, or they're more fun to talk about than they are to watch. And so it got me thinking, because in those aforementioned groups, people are always saying, well, they love the stranger. And the stranger was this, I mean, it's fine, but it's just this pressurized hack work, really. Wells didn't think it was any good. He just was sort of doing it to show that he could bring something in on time and make a little bit of money. He's trying to do a trope-based film. And Orson Welles and tropes, they don't really go together. It's kind of like awkward. So you have these moments of artistry where it works. And I think Chimes at Midnight is his purest film in that sense. But it's also, in a way, hamstrung for the neophyte by being Shakespeare. And if you say to someone, I had an orange for lunch today, most people are going to be like, oh, why'd you ride a camel to work? It's very difficult to say something that anyone really is going to understand. I'm always thinking about that person on the other side of the table. It's not like how I live my life. So you have other examples, and we mentioned The Third Man, but he's acting in that, and Fountain of Youth, which we've talked about before, the TV production for Desilu, or Return to Glenna Skull, The Perfect Ghost Story, but he only like nominally directed that. So you have this concept of Orson Welles, but that's sort of the lens through which we end up seeing I have this friend, he's a bright guy, and I put up a shot from Lady of Shanghai on like my Facebook page, like the little story thing. And this guy, who's like very non-confrontational, he gets in there and he says, worst Irish accent ever. Like, whoa, boy, that seems like it came out of nowhere. And this is someone who came to Harvard to listen to me talk about Magnificent Ambersons. This is like an Orson Welles guy. So I'm thinking, like, I don't think he really likes these films that much. There's just kind of a lot of that. And yet at the same time, to discuss them and read about them, it's just some of the richest experiences that I think you can have with the right guy, so to speak.
Colin Fleming. Love talking Orson Welles with you, Colin. Thanks so much, and we'll check in with you again next Tuesday.
Okay, sounds good.